fourth case today, Smith versus Power.
May it please the court, Mr. Koenig. My name is Charles Roos, Jr. I represent Paul and Gloria Smith. And the issue brought before this court is the extent of whether or not the defendant, as an assistant city attorney, and the district court's ruling, were able to cross that very high bar of being absolutely immune for the acts sued on. The acts sued on were the preparation by the assistant city attorney of a 15-day notice under Illinois law, which is meant to provide the property owners, and in this case, as the complaint alleges, the defendant knew that the plaintiffs were not the owners of the property, with 15 days in which to cure those defects. For absolute immunity to attach, the acts of an attorney have to be intimately associated with the judicial process and not advocating anything.
Well, isn't the... Well, two things. First of all, don't we have to find something done in the complete absence of all jurisdiction, number one, because you wouldn't have absolute immunity anymore if every individual act could be assessed for whether it was within the general scope of authority. Then everything would be subject to a lawsuit. That's my first question, essentially whether the Stump versus Barkman standard applies here. Secondly, since your lawsuit has focused on his preparation and filing of this notice, which is part of the process of a lawsuit. It's like many situations where there's a preliminary thing that has to be filed and then the lawsuit itself can follow at some point later. No prosecutor could bring the complaint for demolition without filing the earlier document. So how can we say that that's not part of his duties as a prosecutor?
Because, to answer your second question first, because of the functionality approach which Kalina and Fitzsimmons bring to bear as controlling, I submit, which is that you have to look at the function and not the identity of the actor.
Right, but he's filed a document. You seem to be wanting us to focus on whatever it is that motivated him to file that document earlier, whether it was his own investigation or whether somebody called him on the phone or whether, you know, any of a number of things might have prompted him to file that document. But in fact, your lawsuit is focusing on the filing of the document, and I don't see why functionally or any other way that isn't part of the judicial process.
It's not intimately associated with the judicial process. Everything can be associated with the judicial process. Kalina dealt with an attorney acting as a complaining witness. That is associated with the judicial process.
Well, but not everything is a statutory prerequisite, is it? And the 15-day notice is a statutory prerequisite.
It's a statutory prerequisite only in the sense that it gives the property owner the opportunity to cure the defects. It is even stronger than Kalina, in that there is no necessary second step. It's not like a finding of probable cause, which then ultimately leads to the charging of a criminal complaint. It is simply a function of investigation, like the policeman in Colina investigating and saying this property has defects in it which make it subject to being demolished.
Well, it's more than investigation because it's a sine qua non to the lawsuit. Now, I'm sure you're right that many of these initial notices may be filed and perhaps there's cure and no lawsuit follows. But it is a necessary prerequisite to any lawsuit that does follow. So in that sense, you can't have the lawsuit without the earlier notice.
Yes, you can. And I've quoted the court, with all due respect, those cases that talk about you can go right to a demolition action depending upon the condition of the property. You don't have to give a 15-day notice.
Well, but those are, you know, unbelievable emergency situations,
that's
aren't
true.
They?
That's
I mean,
true.
Like if the place is on fire.
Of course that's true, but the point is that with this very high bar of absolute immunity, with qualified immunity standing in the background as a protection, the line that the defendant's attorney crossed was quite clear. He investigated. He was acting as an investigator.
Well, we don't know that. All we know is that he filed the notice.
That's true. That's true. And that is why this case should be reversed, because there is no evidence. I mean, the defendant cited this court with the...
But if he didn't do any of the... You know, you are suing him for something that he did by walking in and filing a piece of paper. That's what I'm having problems with.
He didn't file a piece of paper. He sent a notice.
Or mails or whatever, you know.
It said that there's too many defects in this property even to enumerate. Which
right,
brings us
the record.
Which brings us to the second count, which is an Ishmael count. You can't focus on the defendant's role as an attorney because this is a code enforcement responsibility. That's what the statute provides. That's why the demolition statute says the corporate authorities, which includes the code enforcement department. If this court affirms this, I submit that it destroys the distinction that has been very long in coming and very strongly set forth both in Colina versus Fletcher and in Fitzsimmons, which is that absolute immunity is very, very rare, that there is no difference between an attorney being a complaining witness, as in Colina, and the defendant being in effect, the complaining witness saying your property has problems.
Can a non-lawyer issue one of these 15-day notices?
Of course. That's the code enforcement. That's why it says in the state statute, the corporate authorities, that's why in the city ordinance cited section 2115 and 2116 about providing the necessary space between what is intimately associated with the judicial process and what is not, when it talks about things being brought to the attention of the attorney, whether it be the corporation counsel or the assistant city attorney. In effect,
counsel, this was a motion to dismiss under 12b-6, was it?
I think so. It was a motion to dismiss because the defendant had absolute immunity.
Well, that's one. That's
I believe
question.
That was a 12b-6 motion. So, which brings me to the point of, you know, we don't know what the defendant's basis was for acting as a code enforcement officer and sending this out.
Did you allege in your complaint that it was actually the conduct you're complaining about was acting as an inspector?
Yes. Outside of his role as an attorney.
An inspector or an investigator?
Well, that's what code enforcement does. They investigate, and then they bring specific code violations to the attorney, or in many instances, an officer of the court I can represent, I have seen the code enforcement had signed a 15-day notice, even though that is not part of the record in response to the court's question. The point being that this would give municipalities carte blanche. All you got to do is put a lawyer in the police car, a lawyer in the building inspector's car, a lawyer in the zoning department's car, and let the lawyer decide if there's a zoning violation, if there's a crime being committed, if there is a...
But you said anyone can do it. You don't have to be a lawyer.
Like his next door neighbor, anyone could have filed this notice?
No, no.
I thought that was your answer to my question.
No, my red light is on, but I'll send
you. Sure. Let me answer the question.
Okay. No. Anybody can bring the information to... That's what section...
But that was my question. My question, as I recall it, was can a non-lawyer issue one of these 15-day notices?
Yes, the corporate authorities can, yes. Which is the code enforcement department.
Forgive me, but I thought you said anyone can, and that kind of makes me up.
No, a person outside of city government, code enforcement can, but they can bring matters to the attention which can result in a 15-day notice.
Well, my goodness, anyone can.
Right, but, and that's why, in closing, that's why the Second District Court of Appeals for the State of Illinois found the 15-day notice unconstitutional because it didn't give the property owner enough time to make the repairs. That's why it's not intimately associated with the judicial process. That is, we submit, coupled with Kalina versus Fletcher, controlling on what the purpose of the 15-day notice is. If the state court has said what you did, that 15 days isn't enough time to cure the defects, that means that the purpose of the 15-day notice is not intimately connected with the judicial process. It means that its purpose is to give the property owner time to cure the defects.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Koenig?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Paragraph 14, in answer to Your Honor's question regarding the allegations of the complaint, paragraph 14 is where a plaintiff specifies his allegations. And to read it to Your Honor, the defendant, while acting as an investigator in his capacity and outside of his role as attorney in preparing, signing, and sending said 15-day notice. That's what the complaint alleges concerning the conduct of my client. The only actions that issue in connection in this case are my client's decisions to initiate the litigation and his sending of the notice. And the issue, as Your Honor has indicated, is after a prosecutor or an attorney has made a decision to initiate litigation, he's complying with the statutory requirement for initiating that litigation, intimately associated with or an integral part of that decision-making process.
Well, but Mr. Koenig, the notice itself does make certain factual representations. For example, that the building has been, inspected and the building's been found to be in a dangerous condition. And to the extent that Mr. Power was vouching for the accuracy of those representations, when he signed the notice, how is this case different from Kalina, where the prosecutor was functioning as a witness?
Well, the court made a specific distinction there. As I recall the case, there was an actual certification of the facts. And the court said, the court specifically said the preparation of the affidavit would entitle one to immunity, but where you departed and where you got into Melly versus Briggs area was you were acting as a complaining witness. You actually certified the facts. Power did not here. Power, in his letter, says it has been determined that your building is in violation. Accepting Your Honor's view that by simply vouching for the facts through signing a letter He vouches for the facts when he files litigation under Rule 11 or under Rule 237 in state court.
Do you see anything a bit odd about the situation here where you have someone who is speaking out against Mr. Power, stating that he, you know, acted illegally on numerous occasions, and then there, and then he's the one, and obviously he's not the only one, is he, that could have signed this?
He's not, Your Honor. He's not
and
the only one.
And then suddenly, you know, their house is demolished? I mean...
Well, I don't know that suddenly the house is demolished, Your Honor.
What, was the house, in fact, ever demolished?
I believe a year later. And plaintiff's counsel's in a better hands to address that issue.
Let me ask you this, because the reason I was asking is the 12B6, we take the allegations and the complaint is true. 14, which you referred to, says that the defendant, while acting as an investigator in his capacity and outside his role as an attorney in preparing and signing the notice, don't we have to take that as true?
It's not an allegation of fact. It's a characterization of a specific act. All he's suing us for, and he doesn't make any mention or allusion to anything else. He's saying, you sent the notice.
You prepared, signed, and
right.
sent the notice.
Right.
And so I guess the question is whether that allegation, whether doing those things makes you an investigator, because your opponent has told us that investigators who are employed by the city can send these notices out.
Correct, Your Honor. I concede that. It's but simply because it may be ministerial, mechanical, if a judge picks up the phone and decides to set a hearing on a case, that's something that her or his clerk could have done. But yet that certainly would not take him out of the role of a judge. And that's what our Seventh Circuit has held in the Wilson versus Kelkoff case. They said mundane, mechanical, ministerial acts, as long as they're related to the process, are entitled to immunity.
So you think those investigators would also be entitled to absolute immunity if they sent the notice?
Under the functional approach, we look at, it's not their role to initiate litigation. It's the prosecutor's role to initiate litigation. That's where the functional analysis comes in. We look at really the function here. The function is the decision-making process and thought to issue, and process to issue litigation. Now, are other acts that the prosecutor takes integrally related to that process? Are they integrally related under the functional approach?
Could we go back to my question? Do you see anything a bit unusual or odd about the fact that these were enemies?
Your Honor, to answer the question, that begs the absolute immunity analysis. The absolute immunity is just that, absolute. So whether there may have been some First Amendment motive at issue does not take the prosecutor out of the prosecutorial role. And that's what I think the court made clear in Immler versus Pacman. It's an absolute immunity, and we don't want somebody to come in and simply say this is politically motivated to get them in the federal court and to cause the prosecutor to be less than fervent in representing the interests of the city.
Let me go back to paragraph 14. I understand your response to be that's a legal interpretation, not a factual statement.
Correct. Correct. It's his characterization of the next phrase. He's calling this an investigator to try and get around absolute immunity. The complaint was dismissed once. He filed an amended complaint grasping onto this theory of investigation. If he wanted to allege and focus us at least on something other than the preparation, signing, and sending of this letter, he could certainly have said, we went out to the building, Powers went out to the building and made an assessment of whether there was some violation. And even Powers' assessment, if somebody presents him the facts and he says, you're violating the code, that to me is a prosecutorial decision.
Well, there has to be a line somewhere, because we've said being the complaining witness isn't so closely associated with the prosecutor's function. Surely if he'd gone out to the building and he was the one poking around to see if it needed to be demolished, he doesn't get absolute immunity for that.
That I would agree with, Your Honor. And again, begging the question, what the Supreme Court said in I believe it was Immler, or may have been Buckley, drawing the line as to where administration and investigation starts and the prosecutor's role ends is difficult. I submit that the line is at least includes a prosecutor's compliance with a statutory mandate that's a precondition to his filing of an action. I mean, the prosecutor's already made the decision to initiate litigation. In Buckley, the court found that, at least here in Buckley, the prosecutor had not made already the decision to prosecute. So your manipulation of evidence in Buckley before you even decided to file a lawsuit was different than your presentation of evidence in Imler versus Packman during the case after you've already made a decision to prosecute. So I think here where the acts are after the decision to initiate litigation has been made and are in compliance with a statutory precondition to the filing of a lawsuit, those are integrally related to the function of the city attorney as prosecutor. There are no further questions.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move.